Welcome to the Sonic Nuance Electronics Podcast, focusing on topics of interest to worship teams as well as anyone involved with musical recording and performance. All right, Mike, tell me a little bit about Zamar Media and its history.
Okay, well, it's a long story, but I'll keep it as short as I can. Zamar started out as just me consulting with churches, church customers who had noticed the work that I had done just working at a church. And the next thing you know, I decided to get a business license and a business card and started doing it part-time. And then the next step was to make it a full-time business, and so I did that, and in the process started growing, and that's been since 1992, and we're looking back, smiling all the way.
So was it a leap of faith for you to go full-time on this?
Yes, absolutely. There was a real opportunity that I had to follow what I felt God's telling me to do during this process. And I had been working in the computer industry for about 20 years and got laid off for the second time and was standing out with a box under my arm of my desk stuff, and felt I heard a word from the Lord that said, got to do your business. And so went home, told my wife that, and there was a little bit of resistance to that, as you can well imagine. And with a baby due, and but you know, a few months later, we made that leap of faith and gave it a shot, and it's worked out for the best.
Awesome, yeah, that sounds kind of familiar. I didn't realize you were in the computer industry. I also was in the high tech field.
Yeah, it's the whole company was really populated with people that have at one time or another been in the high-tech industry here in the Bay Area.
So. Oh, that's great. I'm sure that's very useful.
We kind of didn't know what we didn't know, and so we did it anyway.
Tell me some of the services that Zamar Media provides.
We started out, as I mentioned, just as a consulting firm, dealing specifically with helping the church market. With audio. The original name of the company was Zamar Sound Pro Audio. About 10 years ago, we realized that we were doing a lot more than that. We were doing a lot of projection systems, a lot of lighting systems, acoustical treatment, and also camera systems, the multi-camera shoots and whatnot. So we tried to be full featured for our customers. We are low voltage, licensed, bonded, and insured California contractors, contractor, I should say. And so the services are everything from consulting to sales, service, installation, training, all of the above.
Interesting. And you mentioned acoustic treatments. Is that like dampening rooms for echoes and stuff like that?
Yeah, we are not acoustical engineers, as one can imagine. That's another whole field. But we do a lot of practical treatment of church facilities. Many of our customers their buildings were designed for choir and organ, and they're trying to do rock and roll in a space that was intended to have a 3-second reverb time. So we do a lot of practical application, see the reflective parallel surfaces and treat them with acoustical treatment of some sort, typically fiberglass or compressed mineral wool fiber products, and then when we need to, we sub out to an actual acoustical engineering firm to help us with reports and full computer analysis.
Interesting. I didn't realize how that was done. Tell me a little bit about the sizes of churches that you work with.
Well, that's a tough one. It varies a lot. Anything from a 100-seat church all the way up to 1,500 to 2,000. The Bay Area has an interesting impact on the church market. And in other large cities, there are many 5 and 10,000-seat churches. But here in the Bay Area, we have the average church size we deal with is probably in the 500-seat realm. So there's not a lot of what the industry calls mega churches, and most of the ones that have had sound installed, we've been a part of or actually done the work, depending upon when it was done.
Do you think that's due to the cost of real estate or some other issues?
I think I've always attributed it. I don't know what the facts are, but my gut feel tells me it's the Bay Area itself, the Bay. Mm. The fact that there's not one big contiguous city, it's a bunch of micro cities attached together with freeways, and people tend to just stay in their little towns. And so it's difficult to fill up a 5,000 seat room in that situation. So it's a lot smaller, medium sized churches that tend to be the bulwark of what we do. Mm-hmm. We like to call them the cake, and the icing is the big church we get to do from time to time.
Got it. Focusing on audio, can you name two or three major changes you've seen in the worship environment since you started the company?
Yeah, I think the biggest change has been the adoption of traditional churches switching over to contemporary type services. A lot of churches call it blended worship. So that's driven a lot of technology changes in the way of the type of speaker systems we install. Instead of small 12-inch two-way speakers to cover a room, we're putting in line arrays, a variety of other products, emphasizing low-frequency response with subwoofers, a lot of quiet stage. Because of these acoustically poor rooms, when a church band tries to come in with drums, electric guitar amps, you name it, and a loud worship set, they've got to find a way to get rid of the stage volume. And so we've seen a lot of inner monitoring systems, mm-hmm. a lot of adoption of projection, and now LED lighting systems have been huge for us as well. Everybody wants to be green. I don't think that's the reason. It's more to keep more green in their wallet than it is into to make a facility green. Because of the cost of maintenance and electrical costs for those systems.
Interesting. Do you find that the LEDs last longer? I would think they wouldn't break down much.
It's a little early to tell. We've just been installing them for a few years. But yeah, I mean, as far as the tests by the manufacturers, they're talking tens of years instead of tens of weeks or months. Hmm. So yeah, it's, you know, we're talking... We usually try to say within 2 to 3 years, an LED system is kind of earning you money because you're not maintaining it. You're not renting lifts to replace light bulbs. You're reducing your energy costs for heating and air conditioning. And you need less lights because the lights tend to be a little brighter. The challenge has been a lot of LED lights don't have the throw up until recently. They don't have the long distance capability, but that's all gone away in the last year or two. Hmm. So they're totally viable solutions today.
And do they generally not have fans, or they still do for the bigger ones?
And most of the big ones have fans of some sort, but they're really working on high CFM, low noise fans. So for the most part, unless you have to stay in the professional realm, a lot of my customers work with the DJ fixtures and they have a lot of problems. We just replaced two small moving head fixtures for a church that has a low ceiling like my office here. And it was too noisy for them, so we sold them a more of a prosumer instead of a consumer type product, and they're very happy with the noise. So paying attention to noise ratings is one of the things we bring to the table as contractors. We have the experience to say, oh, you can't have a noisy fixture, so this is a selection choice for you. Mm.
And that leads to my next question. So churches on tight budgets, what advice do you give them in terms of obtaining gear to get started?
It's a real simple one. Most of the people come into me with a big long laundry list. And when I get down to how big the budget is, it's my typical comment to them is they're a zero off. They've got to add a zero to their budget to get the list that they want. So what we do is we try to convince them to allow us to steer them to sell them the right gear, not the pile of gear they think they need. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is we try to make sure that they have the gear that will allow them a good solid foundation towards a professional quality system without going down to the local music store or buying stuff on the internet that's DJ based or something that's not really professional based, something that they're not going to hate us for in 6 months. If that's the problem, they buy this gear and it tends to be junk and they don't know it's junk. There's a a little joke we say, you know, most churches think all 12-inch two-way speakers must be the same because they have a 12-inch driver and a horn, so they must be the same. But you can buy one for $100 or you can buy one for $10,000. And they sound progressively better and have longer throw, just better sound quality, all of the above. So they tend to, so, and that's where we hold the line. We don't let them buy the wrong stuff because we say I would walk away from a sale before I'd let them sell them something that I knew was bad. Not to say that we don't let customers cut budgets. We do. And reduce it, and then we'll go with lower budget gear. One of the things that's happened in the last 10 years or so, the industry has, through a variety of manufacturers, come up with very cost-effective gear that is pro-quality but at a fraction of the cost. Variety of mixers, lighting systems, you name it. From top to bottom, there are budget-minded systems. They don't have the longevity of the expensive gear. You know, one of our, the other thing that happens to our customers, they all believe that if they buy, they'll ask me if I design a $50,000 sound system for them. They're like, well, is this the last sound system I'll ever buy? And I go, no, I don't know anything else you can purchase on this planet that you're not going to have to replace in some number of time, some number of years. So that applies to audio gear as well as, you know, you name it. So all technology will wear out.
Yes. For the bigger churches, in terms of sound, what is the trend you've been seeing lately? Like subwoofers, cage drums, LED lights, that kind of stuff.
You know, it's, well, that's the challenge. Our small churches want the same thing the big churches are doing. So what we do is economy of scale there as best as we can. So, you know, instead of installing, let's say, an upscale mixer, we'll install a downscale mixer. So the technology right now is quite scalable. So if somebody wants a 48-channel digital console, I can do that a variety of ways, down to a few thousand dollars to tens of thousands of dollars. So what we try to do is match up the equipment with the goal and the vision of the church. And so I wouldn't say the mega churches have done anything other than embrace LED lighting before. LED house lighting has been a huge one with color, red, green, blue, so they can get full color washes of the crowd and of the spaces. So that's been a big one. They probably embraced high definition video much quicker than the smaller churches just because of cost. I think obviously they're usually a few years ahead of the smaller churches. So all the smaller customers right now are catching up with my bigger churches. That's why I like to take my customers to my bigger churches so they can take a look at what the guys that they're admiring, if you will, and find a way to help them get some of that technology installed in their facility.
Oh, that's a good approach. So before you even engage with them, you invite them over to one of your other installations. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, we do a lot of what I call dog and pony shows. So we show off what our skill set is, and they'll walk in and go, oh my gosh, we can't afford any of this stuff. I said, no, you can. It just, we either have to do it in with lesser gear, lesser cost gear with similar capabilities, or we have to do it in phases. So we like to do phases when we can. We find out most of the churches, when I spec a multi-phase installation, tend to stop after the first phase. I think a lot of times they have such big dreams that the gear that we install doesn't quite match their vision, and sometimes they get a little frustrated with that. It may go to another supplier for that. But then again, some of them come, a lot of them today, many churches are coming back saying, okay, we're ready for the lighting system. Okay, we're ready for this. We're ready for curtains. You know, we're ready for whatever. So it is happening. It's just, it's kind of a change. And I think the biggest problem we've had is a lot of churches have been do-it-yourself for so many years. They struggle paying money for what they got for free, even though for many, many years, what's being done for free has been, as we like to say, worth what they paid for it. And so now they're fighting, okay, well, we hear you guys are the guys, and we think you're too expensive for us, but we know we have to do something to change what we've been doing over the past 10 to 20 years, and we think you might be the people to help us do that.
You touched on this a little bit. For an existing building that needs an acoustic treatment, how do you proceed to determine what's needed? You mentioned some tests that you do.
Right. Well, our practical approach is to just come in, and I spent some time under a bit of tutelage, if you will, under some very notable people who have been involved in acoustics and people I've hired to help me over the years. And they've taught me some basic quick techniques with parallel reflections, flutter echo, those kinds of things. And I do some basic tests myself to find out what the reverb time is in a particular room and work towards the basic approach of, you need X amount of absorption to cut, a 3 second reverb down to a second and a half. But we tend to do mostly practical on our own without subbing out to a acoustical engineer. But that person, when we do that, they'll come in and do a full analysis, take measurements around the room, do all sorts of things with a variety of different sounds. And then they'll generate a full report that explains why. The end results aren't a whole lot different than our practical approach, but there's a certain level of confidence in some of my customers where they have a hard time thinking, well, if I just throw some panels on the wall, I'm going to fix my problems. Mm-hmm. In reality, 80% to 80 to 85, 90% of the acoustical issues we can solve with simple panels on the wall, or with a mixture of diffusers as well and bass traps. So there's a variety of things we do, just simple practical approach kind of stuff. I read an article once called "Dead Cats on the Wall," and he's kind of, what? That sounds gross. But what he's talking about is soft, fluffy things on the walls that will make them acoustically inert or acoustically diffuse. And it was actually an article in Live Sound or one of those magazines. But it really supported the approach I take of, we can just put some soft, fluffy stuff on the walls and we'll take care of most of your problems. That last 10, 20% is very expensive and requires detailed reports mm-hmm. and a whole lot more treatment. So what I try to do is find a way to remove the gross problems in the room and let the fine problems in with the system of the room be taken care of by more, pattern control speaker systems. That's probably one of the topics I should have brought up on the last question is what some of the technologies that we're embracing for churches and we see in churches is putting in full concert sound systems that point all the sound at the seats and where the people are and put very little sound on the walls. You don't have to treat walls if there's not a lot of sound reaching them.
Interesting.
So that's part of our package now is to put in accurate aiming of speakers and high Q systems that provide pattern control to where I can just focus the energy of the sound system or the majority of it on the people and not overexcite the room, especially in these large A-frame churches that everybody built back in the day. They're just acoustically terrible for rock and roll worship, yet that's what they all want to do.
I would imagine that the acoustic response of a room changes drastically when there's a full congregation in it.
It depends. If it's a facility with wooden pews and hard floors, yes, it changes drastically. But a facility with padded, regular chairs, the difference is not quite so severe. And we tend to, I look at the room, I kind of say, okay, what am I going to have to do with the high frequency here? How much is going to be absorbed by the people and how much is already absorbed? And I would say it's more of an art than a science at this point for the way we do it, but it works. I tend to make a system a little bright when I'm adjusting it. And so when the absorption mm-hmm. comes in, the system has got the cut it needs to get through the bodies, if you will.
That makes sense. So much of what you do seems like custom-related work, and I liken it to a home remodel or a kitchen remodel that we did many years
right.
ago. So there's no typical job, but what do you find most customers need when they're looking for an audio system upgrade?
To be honest with you, training. It's almost the gear, to be honest with you, they have leaned to the gear for years, and I tell stories about when I go into churches. I've gone into churches and they tell me they got all these problems, and I grab their mixer, their analog mixer with non-high Q speakers and no acoustics in the room, and dial 3 or 4 knobs, and they're just looking at me going, what the heck did you do? And I'm like, okay, this is operator issues. Yes, your system needs to be improved, but without good operators, the technology is only going to have not its full benefit.
Got it.
So we spend a lot of time making sure that every system we sell with training. It's part of the package. And so I'm usually there for, we train them ahead of schedule on a digital mixer if they're buying it. We then show up on the first rehearsal night, which I did one this week, and we dial in the sound system and the mixer, and then I show up on the first Sunday and make sure it's, so basically I've proved concept. Mm-hmm. For example, I did a job the week before last, and I was there for the first and second service, but the third service I didn't stick around, and the second and third were the same exact band. And I had done a mix, and I had recorded it on the USB drive, and they loved it. And then I got a call on Monday going, what happened between second and third service? I said, well, your engineer took over. He goes, yeah, he completely destroyed your mix in less than about 10 minutes. And it sounded terrible in the room, and it sounded terrible on the recording. And I said, well, then I highly suggest you get that gentleman in our upcoming hands-on mixing workshop so we can begin to train him on how to listen. So the biggest problem is most church technical people tend to be computer people who are very savvy about electronics, about software, but they don't have a clue how to make an acoustic guitar sound like an acoustic guitar, especially when there are two of them on stage. And so we go through that whole exercise with them in about an 8-hour, 9-hour day in a hands-on mixing workshop. And that is where we begin to convey the passion you need to be a good sound engineer and the techniques you need to be a good sound engineer.
Ah, that makes sense. I saw on your website several of those mixing workshops, and now I see the dots being connected.
Yeah, for me, it was really, as a Christian, I really felt an obligation to make sure that my customers were getting training to use all this gear. I'm selling them lots and lots of gear, and it's really difficult for me to come back in a month or two and find out that they're not happy with their system, and it turns out they're just not happy with our operators, but they don't know that. And that's why we do that proof of concept up front, and we make sure that they're aware that, okay, this system sounds great in the hands of a competent engineer. And, you know, then the next question out of their mouth is, well, where do I hire somebody? Well, there's almost nobody out there available to do this. There is a dearth of technology people available for AV across the board, across the nation. And it's the biggest problem we have is this. We're a misunderstood technology. Most of the people see AV as just something you turn it on like you do at home and it works. They don't realize that it requires professional skills. And so they buy this gear and it doesn't work. And then they get frustrated. And then the decision makers in churches now are, well, I've spent all this money and we don't have anything improved. What's up? You know, and it's like, well, you keep grabbing people out of the pews and throwing them in the sound booth and expecting them to be a sound engineer. You wouldn't dream of doing that with a piano player or a preacher, but think nothing of grabbing somebody who's just willing and making them the sound engineer. And they don't know what they're doing and they struggle and they get frustrated. The church gets frustrated. So to me, the most important thing we do is educate. And that's where the buck stops.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought of that, but looking back, I think a lot of it is education.
Clearly, and there's a lot of bad education. Part of the reason I started training is when I was trying to get out of the feedback every Sunday mode as a sound engineer at a church, I realized people, I'd go to classes and they would just sit and talk to me about how to mix sound. Well, that's like trying to learn to play guitar with, you know, just not having a guitar in your hands. It's impossible. And it's impossible to learn to do sound without listening to sound. And people think they can come in on a Sunday morning or an hour a month and be a good sound engineer. I don't know any professional job you can do with an hour a month with zero training ahead of that. It's impossible. So the results are only as good as the effort you put into it. And these people, my goal of my hands-on mixing workshop is to ignite passion and make them dangerous. I tell every pastor who sends their people in, you know, they're going to be a little dangerous for a while because they're going to be twisting knobs they've never touched before. But the end results will be great. I had one good customer of mine came up to me and got right in my face one day when I was there doing something else. And I thought he was mad at me. And turns out he was trying to compliment me. He said, you know, Mike, that money we spent sending our sound engineers to your class was the best money we've ever spent. And nice. So that level of vindication comes out quite often. So it's always nice to know that it works. It doesn't always work, but it does work.
Yeah. And since you mentioned education, I think it's not just for the sound team. Well, even though the band is, I consider that part of the sound team, but I know as a worship performer, whenever there's somebody new coming in, if they haven't played in a worship environment, there's a learning curve there too, like especially with using in-ear monitors and singing and
Exactly.
actually hearing yourself in detail is pretty scary the first time.
Yeah, it's very revealing. I like to call it, it's both glorifying and horrifying. And yeah, the first time you see somebody put on in-ears and they just listen to things and they go, what in the heck is that? And I'm like, I don't know how to tell you, man, but that's the way everything sounds. And they're just like, okay, we got some work to do. I go, yep, that's the work to do. So I think from that perspective, the in-ear monitor thing, it really is a good thing. I've noticed, I've gone into the churches, hooked them up on in-ear monitors, and they argue and complain for about an hour. And then about an hour later, after the rehearsal's over, they have gotten anywhere from 30 to 70% better as a band because mm-hmm. they're now hearing everything in time. They're hearing every yep. part. And I did a thing with my church where I had to take them off in-ears for one evening. And at the end of a two-hour session trying to get their monitors dialed in for them, I had the worship leader look me in the eye and said, that will never happen again. I will never go back to floor monitors again after a couple of years on in-ears. So once the conversion is there, it's actually worse or better, however you want to look at it, that they want to stick with in-ears because they realize for the first time in their life, they're hearing every piece and they're singing in context. And everybody is revealed and knows when they're playing the part badly or not in context. So it all works. It's just a challenge. You get somebody who's never had monitors for 30 years of their career. They struggle heavily with the going mm-hmm. away from images.
Yeah, I happen to think that in-ear monitors is one of the biggest improvements in terms of band sound quality, not just like tones and whatnot, but hearing a click track when mm-hmm. the congregation's not, knowing that they're out of time, hearing how they blend, that kind of thing. I think it's really been a great thing.
Agree. I agree with you completely. And yeah, you hear that band, suddenly everybody's playing to the same beat instead of listening to the wrong thing or listening to a snare bounce off a wall. Now they're hearing it directly in their head exactly at the same time as everybody else. And you know, you put people in drum enclosures, now suddenly the drum beat that they hear acoustically is out of time with reality because it's bouncing off the shield, bouncing off the mm-hmm. walls. By the time they hear it, it's who knows how many. It's anywhere from a quarter to a half beat off easily, sometimes more, depending on the size of the room.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
I think we'll come back to the shields question in a bit. But,
okay.
Volume. It seems to me that a common complaint with churches, whether it's the band or congregation, is with volume. Do you have any tips on dealing with this?
Yeah, well, it really depends on where it's coming from. Typically, it's from the floor wedges, so in-ear monitors, once again, solve mm-hmm. that. Amplifiers, we try to go ampless. A lot of churches will deal with that. Some much prefer the tone of guitar amps. I prefer the tone of guitar amps as well, but getting the volume out. So doing a lot of things with, guitar cord extenders so they can run a guitar amp, you know, 50 feet away in a closet to mm-hmm. pad it, and it's mic'd so they get the tone that they want and they still get the advantage of, all of the pedals they want. So a lot of it varies from church environment to church environment. For a long time, we had this big move where everybody couldn't stand drum shields, so they went to electronic drums. And now the move is working back towards drum shields because they realize electronic drums have their own set of problems. Now, in some rooms, they're required. Mm-hmm. I have some rooms where it's impossible to corral the drum sound. And if the drum sound is driving worship up to 100 dB, that's a problem and there's nothing you can do. It's like, well, Pastor, if I turn down the band, the drums I have no control over. So suddenly what all you're going to hear is drums. And they're like, well, what do we do? I say, well, you have two choices. Well, there's three really. I mean, electronic drums is the worst choice. A shield is a next worst choice, if you will, or a better choice. Mm-hmm. But typically what I like to do is a more proactive approach with convincing them to buy a lot of these guys have DW rock and roll kits and wonder why they sound 120 dB at 10 feet from this kit. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll go buy a Yamaha recording kit. It's a fraction of the volume and has the same basic tone. Buy oil dampened heads, moon gel, light sticks, mm-hmm. light rods, you name it. There's all sorts of choices they can do. Or, and it could be up to and including, fire the drummer because he refuses to play. When he starts a snare hit over his head, there's going to be problems. I don't care what stick you play with.
Yeah, so, I find the best drummers can control the volume a lot better.
But not the younger drummers. They haven't learned, you know, feel yet. It's all about, their timing is totally dependent on hard hits. Mm-hmm. How do you tell that guy? I mean, suddenly he plays softer, but he's not playing anything that you want to hear. So there's a big challenge there. So that's where the lighter sticks, you know, I make sure these guys don't play with the plastic tip sticks because they have a lot of attack and pain. Hmm. There's a lot of things we can do. I just had this discussion this week with a worship leader, and you know, I'll usually give suggestions, and they usually tend to work. But drum shields are still a part of the solution. But one of the things people do is they buy drum shields and they don't put acoustic absorption in them, and then they actually create sometimes worse problems with a non-dampened shield. And I'm not advocating lids, but I am advocating acoustics on the shield, because that shield has now become like a megaphone. It basically there's all these reflection sounds coming off the drums, back into the microphones, sometimes as loud or louder than the initial hit. And so it creates a really confusing sound from a drum kit when you don't absorb it properly within the shield.
One of my concerns lately is cymbals. I'm beginning to think that the problem, part of it is drummers hitting them too hard, but I think the other problem is they're just too bright for a lot of rooms. Have you had any experience with like trying darker cymbals, and has that helped?
100%. It's probably the best thing that I've seen done. At my church, we just recently made this switch to dark cymbals. Unfortunately, a good sounding dark cymbal isn't cheap. It can be as much as the drum kit for the cymbals. A lot of money involved in it, but when you get the right cymbals, my story is where I mix sound. I basically, when the drummers were hitting the cymbals at full drum volume, I had to turn the overhead mics completely off, so I had a group fader set up for the overhead mics. I would turn it off, and then as the song wound down, I would slowly bring in that group fader until the mics were on, and then they'd start tinkling on things in between parts, and so I'd have to, I was doing a 60 dB swath between mics on and mics off to keep them in context with the mix. And when we went to dark cymbals, I make maybe a 5 dB swath now. Wow. So it was huge. It was absolutely huge. But this, as I said, the cymbals weren't cheap. So, but it's arguably a foundation instrument. You're going to have to spend money to make it right. We also switched over from, a lot of people make a problem with their snares. They'll buy the thin pork pie or piccolo snares.
Right.
They sound wonderful on stage, but they're a disaster for vocal mics anywhere on stage. The drum hits off of one of those thin snares will be 10 to 15 dB over the loudest singing sound in the microphone at the vocalist mic. So every mic on stage becomes a drum mic with those kinds of things. So a deep rock and roll snare with a dark cage and decent heads and properly tuned will sound a million times better in the mix.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right. The snare is the other thing that tends to hurt my ears.
Snare and cymbals are the problems. Mm-hmm. In particular, the crashes, or a lot of guys are starting to play crash sounds on a ride, and that unfortunately is, that's an interesting sound. I don't like it, and I don't think it works well, because it goes on and on forever. It's just this constant shattering sound going on, and the dark cymbals took care of that as well. So,
do you happen to know what makes the dark cymbals so expensive? I had no idea they were that much.
Well, I don't know, but I did touch them and feel them when we put them in, and they're thicker, and they seem to be made out of a different alloy, but I can't tell. They literally are physically darker. I don't know if that's just paint or what, but it looks like they're actually darker. So I think it's a different alloy, as best I can tell. Don't know for a fact.
Sure. Interesting. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Wired or wireless mics?
Well, that all changed this week when the FCC sold off the 600 megahertz band. We are approaching an era in wireless mic land where when I first started with wireless mics, they were virtually trouble-free devices. I could, they just worked and we didn't have any problems. Well, now the airwaves are very convoluted, and the FCC has sold off two major bands in the last few years, and we don't know what's going to happen. I'm actually attending some educational seminars in the next couple of weeks trying to figure out how to deal with this. Wireless, from a quality perspective, is very, very good right now, especially in the digital realm. There are many different digital mics, really good quality analog UHF mics. So mics aren't the issue. It's the airwaves that are the issue. You know, I do tell people, tongue in cheek, so to speak, if you never want your microphone to fail, put a cord on it. If you're willing to live with an occasional dropout or hiss or whatever it might be, then realize wireless mics will do that for you. But they also clean up a stage, so it's a huge argument. Clean stage is very important for churches. They don't want pastors tripping over cords in the middle of the message and all that sort of stuff. So, obviously, cords are clearly good, but corded mics today just have wonderful quality, and there's no reason not to use them. We are still struggling with issues with the guitars running because they're, you know, companion going on in most of the analog systems. The digital systems don't have that and tend to sound a lot better. But we just recently had some firmware updates we had to do on some of the new digital mics that have been causing problems for the past year. So, yeah, you know, it's a technology. It's another level of technology that's subject to failure, but they're pretty stable right now. That's not including what will happen with the occluded airwaves that we're going to be crowded airspace we're going to see in the next year or two. So the verdict's not in yet. We don't know what's going to happen.
So I don't know the story of this, but it sounds like FCC has allowed more frequencies in the bands that would be used in worship. So there's the potential for a lot more interference. Is that what you're thinking?
Now, the issue is wireless mics have been occupying either the VHF or the UHF spectrum, the same exact space that TV stations have been using. But there aren't a lot of TV stations, and there's a lot of bandwidth, and so a TV station takes a chunk of it. So you can now, if this is the chunk, you tune around that, and it's absolutely critical to buy microphones, wireless mics that have great tunability. The simple systems are either fixed frequency or have only 10 channels they can tune, which means you might get two or three good mics without interference.
I see.
If you're lucky, you buy the more expensive systems and you can put 50 of them on there because they have so much better control of the transmission of the radio wave and then the reception and their rejection of non-wireless mic radio interference. There are even microphones that will automatically self-tune themselves. They'll hear interference on a particular frequency. They'll switch to another one, send a radio wave to the microphone to say, okay, you need to switch now too. And it does it seamlessly. Now, those systems are exorbitantly expensive, as one can imagine, but it's what they use in Super Bowls and at the U.S. Congress and things like that. They buy those kinds of systems. My average customer, no, they're not going to be doing that. So the issue is right now that they're working well, but as they start moving TV stations around and putting them into spaces where wireless mics are operating, if you're in the same town as that TV transmitter, you're going to have dropouts. But that's not the real issue. The real issue is these are now been purchased by people who own these frequencies, and your microphones are actually operating in an illegal frequency, and there have been cease and desist orders come from these very expensive companies. We're talking major corporations that have spent billions of dollars to buy these radio spectrum. And from a church perspective, it's got to do the right thing. And so these people are out there operating illegally and stepping on things. For example, there are public safety bans that we have to stay out of. And so we actually have a chart that we look at. We make sure we tune and do RF scanning technology. We actually go out and do an RF scan to make sure what kind of radio waves the church is going to have to deal with, and we tune around them and give them the best frequencies that we can. The problem is that along with these TV stations moving around, they're also giving away these spaces into what's called white space devices. Spaces between TV channels are called white spaces, and those white space devices are being made by a variety of manufacturers for Wi-Fi, you name it, on UHF bands. Imagine having Wi-Fi that would one transmitter that work in your entire building. That would be pretty cool. And when you're in the gigahertz range, you can't do that. But when you're in the megahertz range, you can do that. So there's a lot of stuff coming, and those people, they're going to sell a lot more technology than the wireless mic manufacturers are. So it's consumer versus pro. You know, pro is small, consumer is huge.
Got it.
Money talks.
Yes, it does. You touched on this as well. Since so many of the people doing worship are volunteers, whether it's the band, the sound engineer, the lighting, what challenges has that posed for your company in terms of equipment recommendations?
What kind of quality? Well, that varies a lot with budgets. Obviously, matching budgets to equipment purchases is the challenge. So for us, we're using, for example, Behringer came out with a very cost-effective digital mixer, and that has been a hot seller for us. It's also created a big training environment. As we switch people from analog to digital, there's a much larger training mm-hmm. curve to be able to actually use all the features of a digital mixer. To do the basic stuff, it's actually easier on a digital mixer because everything's labeled, and when you press a button, the channels all change and all those kind of things with moving faders. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but that's a bit of the concept.
I've also appreciated recently how the digital mixers are a good training tool for new sound engineers too, where you can record the service if you have enough channels, and then you can bring the recording on an off day and say, okay, you mix this.
Right. They call that virtual sound check, and it actually works quite well. Not many churches actually enable it. The challenge is to get people to come in after hours and play with the system. It's difficult to get a lot of the volunteers to do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that technology has helped us quite a bit. I think too, the digital mixers, where they really changed is the visualization of equalization. When we EQ something with an analog mixer, it's strictly by ear. There's nothing to see except the position of the knob. Mm-hmm. With the digital mixers, there's literally a screen with the frequency response on it. A lot of them actually have analyzers on them, so you could see where, let's say, there's a rumble sound or a deep growl coming out of somebody's voice, and you'll be able to see that on the frequency, and you could say, oh, it's right there. Now I can do that. So there's a visualization that you don't get on an analog mixer. And I think that piece alone, if people spend the time with it, it makes it a very valuable tool. When we teach people how to mix in our hands and mixing workshop, we use a digital mixer as the teaching mixer and put it up on the big screen so they can see everything we're talking about. And we show them how, you know, an equalizer works and how it sounds when it works. And so they can now begin to have a reference point in their mind as to how an equalizer works, as opposed to I go into a lot of churches and I look at their mixers and I go, well, the equalizers are all straight up, you're not using them. And they go, we don't know what they do, so we mess with those knobs. I probably hear that more than anything. We don't touch that because we don't know what it does. So they have a mixer that'll do 500 things, and they're using 5 things. Oh. And then the pastor wonders why it doesn't sound good. And I'm like, okay, that's like, you know, buying a Ferrari and use it to go to the park. And it makes no sense.
Right.
You know, so those kinds of things.
On your website, I saw that Zamar Media also provides maintenance services. What does that entail in terms of audio?
Okay, well, for us, it's mainly, it isn't just audio. It's my service guy is responsible for maintaining all the systems we have. It's basically my system's malfunctioning. They call us up. We dispatch for a fee, of course, and he goes out and diagnoses the problem. Then orders the parts, fixes it on site if you can, wants to go back and do a repair. With the diversity of systems we have, it's impossible to stock enough parts. No one's stocking parts in today's world anyway. Everything's an order-only environment. Mm-hmm. So what we'd like, we're not really a service house for the average church. My service organization is there to support our customer base. We do respond to customers who haven't bought gear from us, but it's a much more challenging environment to go into because we don't know the system. Mm-hmm. So we have to go in. And most of the time, there isn't anybody on site who knows how the system is built. When you ask them, where's the wires run? Where are the amplifiers? Where is the equalizer? They don't know any of this stuff. They don't even know this. I don't know. We just show up on Sunday and this doesn't work. Like, okay, well, go away for a while. I'll come back in an hour or two and tell you what I find. And so we're really there to try to maximize our customers' investment. And a lot of people will call us up and say, well, I've had this microphone for 15 years and it doesn't sound good anymore. And we're like, it's probably reached end of life. Mm-hmm. We've noticed that a lot of audio gear, and the manufacturers wouldn't like hearing me say this, we have a lifespan. And we found that the viability of a product, mainly in the analog realm, digital is a bit new, Anywhere from 7 to 10 years. Could you get 15 to 20 out of a piece of gear? Absolutely. But if it starts malfunctioning, especially knobs with a bunch of analog mixer or knobs on them, a mixer with analog knobs, those things start having issues within 7 to 10 years. That's a rough estimate. And when somebody calls me up and says, oh, my mixer, I've had it for 15 years and it's not behaving well, I'm like, well, I could try to fix it for you. And I actually had some people hire me to try to keep their mixers running, and we couldn't. I mean, they just, everything was worn out. It just, you know, basically I can make it sound good for another month or two, but I can't make it fix it for years. So that's, we basically had realized that lifespan is critical, you know, for people to understand that just because they spend $10,000 on a mixer 10 years ago doesn't mean that it's going to be worth that in 10 years later.
Interesting. So things like faders and scratchy pots and that kind of thing.
Well, those, yeah, if you've got an early life scratchy pot, yeah, we'll go in and spray some pot cleaner on there. There's a product we like to use called the Cramelin's, the company name. The trade name is Deoxit. It's the only one we'll use. It's a product I discovered years ago that companies like NATSA and HP were using, and it really works. It actually provides a really good cleaning and lubrication of an electrical contactor or a resistive fader. But in the digital realm, these faders are they're encoders. They're not they're not potentiometers and faders, right. So they're not really replaceable. A digital mixer is pretty much send it back to get it repaired. And there are repair houses that will repair the analog gear, and like some of them are probably trying to come up to speed on out of warranty repairs for some of these mixers. But and then when you're talking about a digital mixer that costs $2,000 for a 32 channel mixer, it's probably not repairable. It's a commodity item, and you probably just replace it when it fails. Unless a lot of times it's just a single channel and you live with it. But a lot of times in a digital mixer, it's going to be catastrophic failure, you know, of major subsystems, not just single channels.
Like the audio engine or the processor in there or whatever.
Exactly. And most of those, we've had very good luck. I can honestly say some of the early mixers, digital mixers we did, we had to replace power supplies and boards and in their things. But we've had, I'd say, a better than expected run of quality with all the digital mixers we've had our hands on over the years.
Great.
So they've been far more reliable than I anticipated they would be.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Moving over to the performer side, do you have suggestions for the musical performers to help make the sound man's job easier?
Yeah, spend a Sunday in the sound booth. Find out what they go through. Walk a mile in their shoes, since most sound engineers aren't musicians, but most musicians could be sound engineers if they wanted to be. But yeah, I think a lot of it is really, you know, feeling each other's pain. I do a lot of team building in my mix class about, you know, passion and the need to serve the musicians during the rehearsal. And then after that, it's serving the song and serving God. And so the challenge is, I think typically most of the friction, in my opinion, comes from the sound booth, not from the stage. But there is both bidirectional issues. But I think, you know, trying to understand each other's pain, as in anything in life, goes a long way towards understanding and improving team camaraderie and just team communication. So I think communicating effectively, understanding that when a sound engineer is in the middle of a Sunday morning sound check and you're screaming to get more monitor and he's already had 10 requests, you better chill, you know, and just take time. And then the other one I think is when you do make a request, say, hey, I need more blah, blah, blah. Well, you say that to a sound engineer and you go, well, how much more? You know, or somebody will just say, well, I can't hear my monitor. What does that mean? You can't hear yourself. You can't hear anything. The speaker's broken. You know, so that's why I challenge my trainees and my class of students to get out of the sound booth, go up there. And when they don't understand what's being said, go experience for themselves. And conversely, the worship team can, you know, be there on time, you know, so that we're not rushing to get stuff done. You know, work with the sound. You got one sound engineer trying to wire a whole band, and yet you got 5-10 band members all making demands of a sound engineer to get stuff done, and, you know, expecting everything to be instant. And it's no wonder there's irascibility coming out of the sound booth. You know, by the time you get through a half hour rehearsal, the sound engineer's trashed and the worship team's ready to roll. And, you know, so the way I look at it is you would never walk up to a pastor on Sunday morning and start complaining about the parking lot, you know, yet that's equivalent to what we do to sound engineers. We come up and we complain and grouse about everything, video guys, lighting guys, whatever the case may be, church tech people. And then we expect them to want to serve God with a whole heart and with a happy heart. Well, at that point, they're squished and they don't even want to be there.
Right.
So why would you want to do that to the guy who's the most responsible for your sound outside of yourself?
Right. And I think they have the hardest job and the most critical job. I consider them the most important part of the band because just in terms of power, they control the volume, right?
Well, the volume, the tone, the compression, the dynamics, the tone, everything. Mm-hmm. And the more you nurture that person, the better your sound's going to be. That's why most bands tour with, you know, a particular person they like as a sound engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I get that when I go to church as well. Can you come back here every Sunday? I said, well, no, but my goal here is to try to pass on a little bit of what's up here to your people and convey that to them. And it works. It absolutely works. You know, it doesn't work all the time because I think the biggest issue is commitment to time. I'm always amazed at how little time band members and technical team members will actually commit to their craft. And I'm just kind of like, wow, man, you sure wouldn't want the Lord to do that for you. You'd want the Lord to serve you in this case. You ask for something, you want it, and here, and you're coming into church late, and then things don't go well, and then you take no responsibility for the fact that you didn't prepare. I show up, I get up plenty early, I make sure I'm up an hour ahead of time before I hit the road, so that I'm awake, fed, you know, got some prayer under my belt, and I head to church praying that, okay, God, make me the best sound engineer I can be today. And, you know, I show up with a happy heart ready to go, and, you know, at the end of the rehearsal, the downbeat of the first set, and the first service sounds like we've been there all day because we've already been there for 3 hours.
Hmm.
I see churches where they show up 10 minutes ahead and wonder why things don't go well. And it's kind of like, what else in life can you do that with?
Yeah.
You can't.
Right. Who do you find is most resistant to new technology on worship teams? For example, guitar players, singers, sound techs. And why do you think that might be?
Probably the guitar players, and mainly because their tone is, they're a team. Them and the amp and their guitar is a team.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start messing with that team, you start messing with their actual tone. And that's the biggest challenge. Conversely, they don't understand that the tone that they hear coming out of their single 12-inch speaker and a guitar amp doesn't really translate very well to a three-way speaker system with a horn. You start sticking that guitar through a horn, it's, you know, there's a guitar through a speaker, there's a guitar through a horn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just sound different. And that's difficult for them. So they have trouble trusting technicians. I just did a thing on this week where I was at a rehearsal and had a great bass player come in, had great tone, playing five-string basses. But you know, we were having some issues with his guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I started what I do, picking a different direct box, trying this, trying that, trying to diagnose what the problems were. And at the end, we finally got it. At the end of the service, the worship leader at rehearsal, the worship leader comes up and goes, you know, I don't have any church that could do what you just did. And I went, what are you talking about? He goes, the way you worked with my bass player, who's a pro, you know, you guys came together, and when you were done, it worked. And he said, I don't have anybody that can do that. I said, well, that's why we need to train them. You know, I said, it would have been nice if they were here tonight for this rehearsal because I modeled this for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I got out of my booth, I went up on stage, I played with their DI, I played the things, and we figured out what the issues were and solved them. And then I worked with him. Turned out he had noisy guitars, and I had to run a gate on things. Well, their guys don't even know how to run a gate.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to the bass player, and I said, I'm going to gate your bass. So you need to tell me if it's cutting off your sustains. And he did. He says, you know, it's cutting off. Can you stretch that delay a little bit? And I did. And then I called back on the monitor and said, well, did that do it? And he goes, yes. He said, that's perfect. You know, so there was a team camaraderie that went on there that that the band members hadn't seen models in the sound booth before, you know, and I wasn't the guy from the church. I was the hired gun.
Got it. All right. For the sound tech that might be listening to this, who's thinking about throwing in the towel due to this being the hardest job, in my opinion, of, on the worship team, what would you say to that person? Do you have any words of wisdom, any suggestions?
Yeah. Pray hard and study hard. Those are the two things I did when I first started out as a junior sound engineer. And as I said earlier in the conversation, it was a lot of feedback. And, you know, my story is pretty simple. I was, the thing that drove me to finally get competent at this was, we had helped install the sound system at my church, and I wasn't really very good at it. And we were having feedback, and I looked over, and the sound, the worship team leader was standing at the sound booth, looking over the booth at me. And, you know, he said, he looked me straight in the eye. He says, "You know what?" He says, "We have a 747 sound system, but we have Cessna pilots." He was mad at me, and justifiably so. I was failing, and I looked him in the eye and said, "Not for long." And I decided right then and there that if I was going to do this for God, I was going to give it my best shot. I'm not a musician, never been a musician, still not, and yet I get a lot of respect for what I do because the end result is very musical. And what I did to do that was I studied hard. I got in every class I could. I found a couple of bands who were dumb enough to let me be their sound engineer, and it just worked. You know, it was just an amazing thing, you know, for me to go through that process. And I actually sat at a rehearsal, and this is what worked for me to teach me the musicianship. And I was a sound engineer at the time for a jazz band. And I sat in the middle of their living room while they were all around me. And I sat in the middle and watched them build a song from scratch. And somebody come in with a melody, and then they'd write all the other stuff around it. And that taught me how a song is built. And so then I started using that technique for my mixes. I said, okay, most church guys build a mix from the vocals down. Well, that leaves a very non-musical mix. I build the mix from the bottom up. I start with bass and drums, and I work my way into the rhythm instruments and then the lead instruments, and then I bring the vocals in. And it takes a little longer to do this, but the end result is far, far, far more musical. And the vocals still sound right if you do the job right, to carve out spaces in your mix. So the challenge there is to learn how to do those techniques, find places to get training. Zamar Media Solutions offers our hands-on mixing workshop every month or two, every 2 to 3 months. And it's probably, it was targeted to do what you just asked, to find a way to get out of this rut I've been in because nobody's been able to teach me. And there's a lot of people teaching what I consider bad techniques to church technicians. There's a lot of articles you can read. The internet is a wonderful place to find both good and bad information. And how would you know if it's good or bad if you have no skills and no one to tell you? So I basically found that way. And so I would encourage them, don't lose heart. You know, pray hard to make sure this is your, this is what God wants you to do, not just because you don't like to sit in the pews anymore. You want to be hiding somewhere else. If you're hiding in the sound booth or the tech booth, that's a mistake. If you're there because you want to serve, then God will honor that if you're honest with him and you commit the amount of time you need to do. You know, God can supernaturally make you a sound engineer, but that doesn't happen too often. The parting of the Red Sea happened once.
Well, thank you so much. Do you have any closing thoughts before we get off the line here?
I don't think so. You know, I just love to be able to share this. For me, it's my passion to do what I do. And I think anybody who's watching or listening to this understands that that passion is what makes all the difference. It makes it fun. Your first day doing a mix and what I call sticking a mix and making it right, you're walking out of that sound booth 10 feet off the air knowing that what you did was help that church communicate the gospel through spoken word and through worship in a way that it couldn't do before you got there. And I don't know how there's any loss in that at all. It's a win all the way around for everybody, and it feels good, and it's fun.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Mike. I appreciate it, and I wish you the best with your company. Take
care. Yes, sir. Thank you, Dad. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this Sonic Nuance Electronics podcast.
Please also see our blog at sonicnuance.com, which has more articles on performance, equipment, as well as interviews. SonicNuance.com has handmade rugged direct boxes with Phantom-powered chromatic tuners, as well as instrument and headphone extension cables. All products are designed, tested, and made in the USA for the ultimate in fidelity and durability. Sonic Nuance Electronics. Simply sound.